Just after 1 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, the Fan, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Smith and Jones hits the air for a Thursday afternoon after the off day for us yesterday, preempted for the Toronto Blue Jays, and unfortunately the Jays dropping their third of three against the Texas Rangers and losing two of three against Texas. So now after the hot start to the season, taking two of three in the Bronx, losing two of three in Texas. But I will say this, Jonesy. At the risk of sounding like the eternal optimist here, I think it's more just trying to be a realist. If you were to say to start the season that you're going to go in and take two out of three against the Yanks, most people would probably say, no, they'll probably be lucky to get one. You know, it's the start to the season, and especially even getting that home opener, that's always a tough one to do. So maybe things are evening out. You know, you can't maybe walk in every series assuming that you're going to sweep. So even going into Texas, maybe you say, okay, the Rangers get one. So you maybe could have, would have, should have taken two or three against the Rangers, but maybe you should have only gotten one against the Yanks. It all comes out even in the wash at 3-3. But more important than all that, due respect to Blue Jay fans, I'm literally on Raptors.com right now, and I'm doing the double check right now. So Jonesy and to the audience listening, play along with me right now. Ananobi, I'm using my fingers and toes right now, okay, Jonesy? You can count along with me if you want. Ananobi's in. Baines is in. Bembry is suspended. We'll get to that in a second. Boucher is in. Flynn is in. Harris is hurt. Hood is hurt. Stanley Johnson's in. Kyle Lowry's hurt. Patrick McCaw's hurt. Pascal Siakam's in. Trent is in. Van Vliet is hurt. Watanabe is in. Watson is still out, health and safety protocols. So given the suspensions that were just announced in the last 30, 45 minutes for the Toronto Raptors, if you missed the news for leaving the bench during the altercation that broke out the other night between Schroeder and OG and Trent and the whole mix, because Van Vliet and Bembry left the bench, they are suspended and thus unavailable. Bembry unavailable tonight. Van Vliet can't serve his suspension while he's hurt, so he has to wait till he's healthy to serve his suspension, but he's still hurt and out with the hip flexor, so the Raptors officially have 8 bodies, the league minimum. That's it for tonight's game.
That's it. I was counting. I got to the second hand with the 8 players. And that's, you know, that's the hard thing. The way the season has gone, I mean, you look at this game as a game that they need. There are 3 games behind Chicago in the loss column. If you're, and again, some people are ready to punt the season and start playing for ping pong balls. And I'm, you know me, never, ever will do that. If I'm losing by 58, I want to lose by 57. Mm-hmm. Just kind of never throw in the towel like that. And these are the games that you figure you can make up some ground. The Lakers without LeBron, and you know, here you are going into a big game against Chicago. But the way the season has been, they can't catch a break. Health and safety protocols. The basketball gods not smiling on them with, you know, missed shots at the buzzer, turnovers. Now you got suspensions. We talk about those games where no matter what happens, you're going to win. Those 10 games every year where no matter what happens. And the Raptors had one of those against Golden State. And then you get, 10 games where, no matter what happens, you're not going to win. And, the Laker game might have looked like that one. But this whole season is like one of those 10 games that you're never going to win, no matter what happens. It just feels like that. Things, bad start, missed shots, internal conflict, health and safety protocols, injuries, distractions around the trade deadline. Not that some of those things don't happen in every season, but the resiliency of this team has been such that they've gotten past it. I don't know. Maybe it's not their year this year in that sense, although – as I said, I'm never one to say throw in the towel. Let's fight right till the end. Let's keep throwing punches right until, the final bell goes, and then you can go back and sit on your stool and say, well, I did everything I could.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what else to say to that, Jonesy. I guess I kind of echo those sentiments. It's just been kind of one of those years, but it really hasn't even been one of those years when we look at it as a total. It's really been one of those last 6 weeks. Because, I mean, now, heck, we can put that 2-8 start behind us. That was the bad news of the season. Now it's really just been the last four to six weeks that have really gone sideways. 2-8 seems like a thrill right now because you fought back from 2-8. You got back to 500. You got back a game above 500. You had one of the top five records over a 20-game span. And then the wheels just fell off, health and safety protocols and everything else that you just discussed. And it just seems like they can't catch a break right now. Now, that said, this is their doing. We'll get into it in a couple of minutes when Stu Jackson joins us from NBA TV and former NBA coach and GM, and he worked in the league office. And I definitely obviously want to talk to Stu about this, Jonesy. They did it to themselves. Van Vliet and Bembry, they know the rules. In fact, I was sitting watching the game with my wife, and I said, that's probably going to be suspension. She said, what do you mean? I said, they left the bench. Yeah. She's like, but he's trying to break it up. He's not involved. He's trying to be the peacekeeper. I said, doesn't matter. And that is a goofy wrinkle in the rule where I feel at least common sense, and I'm not just saying this from a Raptor standpoint. I promise you folks, I would say the same thing if it was the Bulls or the Lakers or the Grizzlies or anybody else. If it's clear, especially upon review, days after the fact, like when the suspensions and fines were announced today, if it's clear in watching the video that player X or player Y or player Z was trying to be the peacekeeper, moderator, trying to break it up, trying to calm things, trying to pull people away from the fray, not antagonize or instigate further or stoke the fires further. That, to me, is where common sense should overrule the rules. You want to slap down a fine, but I'm not sure that that rule should be as black and white as it is in terms of you leave the bench, it's a suspension. I don't know if I love that. I really don't know if I love that rule, Jonesy.
Yeah, the NBA can be pretty strict with it. I mean, I think back to the series years ago with the Heat and the Knicks, mm-hmm. where guys just 1 foot over the line and guys were suspended. You had a game where they had so many guys suspended, they had to break the suspensions up. Like these three guys, there were seven guys suspended. But these three are suspended for this game, and these four are suspended for the other game. There was just so many people. The NBA's, and we can talk to Stu about it, the NBA's very, they were in the beginning with David Stern, they were absolutely inflexible and unrelenting about it. You got up and stepped over the line, like just 1 foot, and pulled your foot back right away. Too bad, you're suspended. I said the same thing too, Eric, doing the game. Like that, Fred's got to be careful. And it would not surprise me if he was suspended, because I've seen guys, unfortunately, suspended for less than that and trying to be, you know, peacekeepers as well. So, I mean, it may have cost Steve Nash his one shot to be in the finals when Robert Horry hip-checked him and, you know, all those guys from Phoenix got into it. So the NBA is unrelenting about that. I would think that you would also take intent into it. And I always say this, Eric, there's a rule and there's an intent of a rule. I mean, the rule is no speeding, you know, 50 kilometers. Okay, great. But if I have a sick child or a sick parent or somebody that needs medical attention, I'm sorry, I'm getting to the hospital and I'm speeding. All right. There's a rule and there's an intent of a rule. And I just think the literal interpretation of this makes it really, really difficult at times. I'd love to talk to Stu about it because he's been in that position many times.
Yeah, and we definitely will talk to Stu Jackson in a couple of minutes when he comes on the air. And Jonesy, we'll ask him all of these questions. And here's the point as well, to further amplify what you just said, is we're clearly on the same page in terms of the intent, or as I say, common sense overruling the rules. I still, to the second, don't really know what OG Anunoby was doing with Dennis Schroeder. At first, I kind of thought he was sort of helping him up or trying to prevent him from falling. But then upon further review, it seemed like Schroeder was actually in a decent spot, and OG literally did just pick him up. Well, I don't know. What are you planning to do with him? Little side body, you know, slam, a little throw down to the ground, WWE style? Well, like, what was the intent? So I have no problem with OG getting a $30,000 fine. That's the other part of this that I didn't mention. I did mention the fines, but I didn't give you the total. $30,000 for OG, but not a suspension. So if we really kind of break it through and go, so the guy that arguably initiated or instigated the entire dust-up whether it was OG, whether it was Schroeder, one of those two is responsible, or both are equally responsible for the whole thing that started and for things getting out of control. But yet, guys that came in trying to break up, not throwing any punches, not throwing down any body slams, not getting anything too heated, they're the ones that are suspended, but not the guys that started the whole thing. And listen, OG, in fairness, had he actually dropped Schroeder, he could have hurt the guy, like hurt him badly. And he's just fined, but not suspended. It doesn't seem to, 2-2 doesn't seem to equal 4 here in terms of the punishment that was ultimately levied. And again, that's not a pro-Raptor stance, because I'm saying I would have been okay, even though I was still even surprised to some extent that he was ejected from the game. I thought it was just going to be a tech, not a full ejection. I'd be fine upon for the review if he said, well, actually, that does kind of look a little shady if he was the one suspended, but to suspend a guy that was just trying to break things up, who was not even in uniform, who was kind of in coach role that night in street clothes, yeah, I got a problem with that. And I'll tell you, this to me, Jonesy, as well, maybe there's probably enough rules that prevent this from happening. But if I'm the Toronto Raptors, I'm pretty annoyed that I announced already yesterday that Fred VanVleet is out for tonight's game. Because, man, I would have done everything I could then to fudge the system. I would have said, oh, yep, actually, he's healthy. He's available for tonight. Yep, that hip flexor's feeling good. He's available. Oh, he's suspended. Oh, okay, well, guess he can't play. And then that buys me time until the next game coming up on Saturday. So now I got to know that my guy that wasn't going to play can't play anyways. And now when he is healthy, he's got to sit out another game as a result. Man, I would have been trying to fudge that thing as best as possible.
Don't. We got the VP, the vice principal of discipline, on the line now. Don't. You're not supposed to say that, E. You're not supposed to say that.
Well, hey, at least I don't work for the team, or I'm not in the front office. If I get that paycheck, then I'll start worrying about that. The conversation. Yeah, go ahead, Jonesy.
That's the first thing I want to ask him. Stu?
Well, go ahead. Do it right
Stu,
now. Yep.
We bring in Stu Jackson, former, as I call it, VP of discipline. But I guess your official title would be vice president of basketball operations. Right, Stu?
Yeah, yes. That's correct. The discipline part, fortunately, was the most public part of my position, which I didn't really relish as much as the other duties that you perform as, the head of operations. But so be it.
Okay, Stu, so let's get a few things clear first. Eric's there being a tough guy behind, well, I don't work for the team. Have you ever disciplined a team broadcaster or
Jonesy, why'd you even bring it up? Come on, you're killing me.
Hey, I'm in there too, because I want to know. I'm just like, I'm throwing you under the bus, Eric, but I'm not backing up over you. I'll pick you up when it's done. I just, Stu, I'll pay a third of his fine. But have you ever had the condition that you've had to talk to a team broadcaster for stuff that's been said on the air?
No, we never have, but I will tell you that there has been the occasion whereby we've spoken to the team if they had a broadcaster that was actually employed by that team who may have said some things or intimated some things that maybe weren't true or might have been misinformed or something that was damaging to the league as a whole. We would just give them a friendly nudge and say, hey, listen, can you get this guy under control? So that has happened, but I don't ever recall, actually fining a team for that or, suspending or asking them to suspend an employee.
All right, Eric, we're safe for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, we're safe. And I mean, listen, if there was a fine or suspension, I would guess to it, they'd have to be scaled based on what radio and TV broadcasters make. So, a $30,000 fine might equate to a $30 fine based on what we earn. Stu Jackson. Go ahead, Stu.
That's not how it works with players now. Everybody gets the same amount of
money. Hey, sorry, we got a bad connection here, Stu. Sorry, I can't hear you right now.
Yeah, I'm going through a tunnel. Yeah.
Hey, Stu, I don't know how much you heard of what we were discussing coming into it, though. But what is your viewpoint, your stance? Again, having been there and the one calling the shots, I understand why the rule exists. And I don't know if you heard me say this, but I promise you, this is not coming from a pro Raptor standpoint. I'd be saying the same thing about any other team in the league, but when you review stuff after the fact and when you're levying fines or suspensions, when it comes to the rule of leaving the bench, the fact that there's no gray area, had Fred VanVleet left the bench or DeAndre Bembry left the bench and actually been in the dust-up and actually been throwing punches or fanning the flames or whatnot, I would be fully behind absolutely suspension. But if you're coming in there trying to be a peacemaker and trying to pull guys away and trying to help the situation, trying to help defuse things, can that not be something that the league looks at and says, you know what, maybe we still fine him, but we're not suspending a guy for trying to be a peacemaker?
Well, yeah, certainly that's a reasonable conversation and an option. But the rule itself of not allowing players to leave the vicinity of the bench when there's an altercation is really a hard and fast rule that's based upon it's based upon protecting players that are on the floor in an altercation, because the last thing you want is a player coming off of the bench engaging in an altercation where the participants in the altercation have no idea that those players are coming off the bench. And having no idea, they are subject to, harm, injury, not being able to protect themselves, as we saw decades ago in the Rudy Tomjanovich, Washington incident. And because of that, you have to protect the players on the floor. Now, listen, the rule also contemplates that the only peacemakers that are allowed in the altercation are the 10 players on the floor, as well as coaches from either team are permitted to be peacemakers. And if you put that all together, it makes sense, but it's all in an effort to protect the combatants on the floor.
So Stu, and you're the guy who's presently holding the bag right now, Kiki Vandeweghe, in that sense, how much would he read an official's report, consult with the officials, look at the video? I mean, these decisions aren't made lightly. I know you, like I said, you sat in that chair, and it's not easy. And whatever you do, you're going to get people that second guess or dislike the decision. Walk us through some of the steps in the decision making, Stu, including, as you've just stated, some parts of the rule that are hard and fast.
Yeah, no, what Kiki Vandeweghe, has gone through the past 24 hours is he's basically going to collect as much information that he can about the incident. And that includes, but it's not limited to, media reports, obviously video footage, interviews of the combatants in the altercation, an official or referee's report of the incident, or any other piece of information that he can gain to understand what precipitated the incident, because sometimes you may penalize one player more than the other if it's a fine involved. He's also, going to gather that information to make an assessment of what the outcome of penalties is going to be. But what he's not going to do is make an assessment with respect to players leaving the vicinity of the bench. That is hard, fast, bright line, and there's no evaluation or analyzing to be done with respect to players that leave the bench. Kiki Vandeweghe knows, the rest of the league knows, the players know, the coaches know, the owners, the general managers know that if you leave the bench, it's an automatic one-game suspension.
Speaking with Stu Jackson. Stu, Jonesy touched on this a little bit earlier before we brought you on, referencing a number of years back. Jones, it was New York and Miami, was it not? Where there were a number of suspensions levied to the point where you couldn't have all of the players out for the same game. So it had to be a couple in this game, a couple in that game. I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyways. When the league, when they're reviewing situations like this, do you take into account the current state of the Raptors roster. Jalen Harris out, Rodney Hood out, Kyle Lowry out, Patrick McCaw out, Fred VanVleet out, Paul Watson out. Six guys already out with injuries and or health and safety protocols. And now with Bembry suspended and VanVleet not able to serve the suspension while hurt, the Raptors are left with the league minimum eight. What if, Stu, what if there was one other guy hurt? Would Bembry be suspended tonight, or would the Raptors be forced to forfeit? Like, well, how does that work? I mean, you can't play with just seven guys, so would the league have to basically wait for Bembry's suspension until VanVleet's healthy, so then VanVleet comes back so Bembry can serve his, and then Fred still owes one? Or how would that have worked?
You have a job in case this radio thing doesn't work out. No, that's exactly how it works. You know,
Stu, don't do that. He'll be suspending and fining people on left and right.
No, if you're unable to field the league minimum, that's correct. The league would make a decision on which player would not serve a suspension, you know, that particular game until, you know, other players that are due to serve the suspension are able and healthy to play. That's exactly what they would do. Yes.
Stu, I want you to put your other hat on now. The suspensions just kind of and stuff just kind of came down before we were going to air, and it was fortunate and opportune for us that we could get some insight from you. But I want you to put your general manager's hat on, because you've worn that before, and you're looking at the Toronto Raptors and the record where they are now. I mean, when you're close to the playoffs, you always try to make a run. They're not that far out of the play-in game. What are you thinking if Stu Jackson's managing the general manager or the president of the Raptors right now? What are you thinking with the rest of this season? You're looking ahead to the summer. You got 10-day contracts. How are you treating the rest of this season, Stu?
Well, you're treating it as, you know, one of, you know, given the tradition of the Raptors and their recent history and years, you're treating this particular season as one of damage control. And the first and foremost, you know, they've gotten hit by the injury bug. So if I'm, you know, Masai Ujiri and, you know, Bobby Webster, I'm just trying to get healthy in an effort so that, you know, I can perhaps, you know, muster enough, you know, of my players being together so that I can make that play-in situation, you know, and become one of those final teams to get myself into the playoffs and give myself a chance to actually, you know, enter the real playoffs. So that's first and foremost. And, you know, while you're trying to do that, sure, you're going to try to patchwork here and there as much as you can by acquiring, you know, assets, whether they be 10-day contracts or whatever, in an effort to fill holes and fill gaps until you can get healthy. It's an unfortunate situation, guys. You know, it happens to every team at some point along the way, and unfortunately this season has been, you know, the Raptors, time. And but that's about all that you can do right now.
Speaking with Stu Jackson, former NBA coach, GM, member of the front office with the NBA as well, NBA TV analyst, again, Stu Jackson joining us. Stu, we've asked this question many times over the last, well, couple of weeks for sure, a couple of months probably. When you look ahead, whether Kyle Lowry is back with this team or not, A, how good is the core that could still be left of Siakam, VanVleet, Ananobi? But also B, does that core matter as much if they don't shore up the depth? Because right now it seems to, when we watch this team on a lot of nights, the starters, for the most part, even the interchangeable parts in the starters, are okay. But there's a noticeable drop-off beyond maybe, what, Jonesy, the sixth man, seventh man? Like, Toronto really does seem to have to really fill that depth more than anything else, because the bench has been quite a bit of a letdown over the course of this season.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, it's not too long ago, a couple of years ago, and we were all, myself included, talking about just how deep the Raptors bench was. And, you know, circumstances over the past couple seasons have, you know, eroded that bench. But, you know, listen, I'm sure if you're, you know, Masai, that's going to be a focal point in the off season, if for nothing else, to try to shore up, you know, their bench. Because I agree with you. When you're talking about, you know, Van Fleet and OG and Siakam, I mean, you have a really good core there of a starting lineup, you know, to move forward with. And that will play, you know, almost, you know, any given night. But, you know, they've got to put themselves in a position where they do begin to rebuild that depth. And listen, rebuilding that depth doesn't always just come from going out and spending money and acquiring talent. It may be the further development of players that are already in, you know, your program. You know, make it up, a Trent, a Flynn, or names like that, that have some upside that can get better to help shore up that bench, in addition to going out and acquiring either through trade or through the draft or through free agency in an effort to shore up the bench.
Hey, Stu, probably the last one for me. I'm looking at the rest of the East and, you know, the way things have flipped, particularly in the division that the Raptors are in, with the Nets being on top now. You know, Harden's got the injury, but Durant comes back, and in limited minutes, he looks pretty good. How important is it for all three of these guys to get Harden, Durant, and Irving? How important is it for all three of them to get some reps together so they can kind of establish something? I mean, it looks like Harden's going to be kind of the point guard in all of this, but, you know, now you're playing without him, and you get one guy back and one guy's gone. How important is it for them to kind of get this thing together so they know what's going on come playoff time?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. I think it's vitally important. And, you know, I've always subscribed to the notion that when you put together a roster that's fairly new and comes together for the first time, and, you know, and listen, let's be honest, the Nets' aspirations are to win, you know, the NBA Finals. But when you have so many new parts and those parts are moving around because of injury, and they don't have the opportunity to play together and to have your team galvanized together, go through those adversities together during the regular season and even the playoffs, I have always subscribed. I think it's very, very difficult to actually win a championship under those circumstances. And that goes almost in any sport, but particularly in basketball, because you only have a five-man starting lineup. So, you know, as great as the Nets could be, I would be surprised if they won, you know, a championship this season with the way the season is unfolding, unless, as you say, they can get all of those guys back, Harden, Irving, and Durant, in a situation where they're playing a significant number of games together. And, you know, and I say that even more so this season because, guys, I mean, there was a day now where people used to say, well, the Eastern Conference pales in comparison to the Western Conference. But as you look at the so-called, you know, super teams, you know, in the NBA right now, you'd have to say three of them are in the East. And that wasn't always the case. You know, you look at the Bucks, the Sixers, and the Nets. They are all very high-level teams on par with the Jazz, the Clippers, the Lakers, and dare I say the Nuggets and the Suns. So it's a little bit of a new day, and it even highlights even more the importance that the Nets get themselves together, because they're going to have a rough go of it here in the playoffs if they aren't really, you know, galvanized as a team.
Hey, Stu, I was going to let you go here, but we're up against a break. But you just rhymed off, you know, six, seven teams right there, which was going to be the question I was going to ask, so I'll ask it quickly here. Is there, as of right now today, one team in your mind that is the favorite then, or is it kind of a crapshoot right now?
You know, I don't think there is a favorite, and I think it's directly proportional to who's playing the best basketball at the end of the year going into the playoffs and who's healthy. I think any one of those teams that I mentioned are capable of, you know, winning, you know, the NBA Finals. And the teams, as you look at it, that have really been through it before, to my point earlier, are the Lakers, right? The Nuggets have been together and fought some adversity together. The Clippers have also done the same thing, albeit that they have a new coach. The Bucks, we know, have been there, only to fall short in recent years. And the Sixers, are still licking their wounds of the last, couple seasons, failing in the playoffs. So you look at those five teams and you say, those teams have been through it. They know what it takes. They felt the pain of not winning in the playoffs and perhaps gained some understanding of actually how to make it through the playoffs. And those are the teams that I would watch for in terms of an emerging champion.
Hey, Stu, we appreciate the time and the insight as always. Thanks for joining us today. Look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks, Stu.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, guys. And, I'm going to report you to Kiki, by the way. Just to give him fair warning, I owe him that.
Eric Smith, S-M-I.
All right, Stu, lose my number. Talk to you later. Thanks.
Talk to you. Bye.
There's Stu Jackson from NBA TV, former NBA coach and GM and a member of the front office as well. We'll step aside, come back, and shift our attention to the Masters on Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. The calm, quiet music, no doubt, for the Masters, so maybe I should be whispering right now doing my golf voice, but I'm getting jacked up for a second because it is also today the home away from home opener for the Toronto Blue Jays. The Toronto Blue Jays take to the field for the home opener at TD Ballpark later today against the LA Angels, and we're giving away Blue Jays prize packs to celebrate, so listen for the secret players' names all day and text them to 590-590 to enter right now if you text Jansen. And again, if you don't know how to spell it, then you're not a Jays fan. Text Jansen to 590-590 right now. Find contest rules at sportsnet.ca/590. And be sure to tune in tonight for the pregame. Opening ceremonies start at 6:30 on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. For a piece of home, the Toronto Gay Men's Chorus will perform the anthems from Toronto. Forte is the name of the group. So they will be playing and singing the national anthem tonight from Toronto as we get set for first pitch of the Blue Jays home away from home home opener down in Dunedin. Jonesy, how much golf have you already watched today?
A lot. I was sick enough to be flipping back and forth watching the loop of connected and also checking out the guys hitting shots on the driving range. They had a feature on Golf Channel where they had guys practicing like at the range, and you could see one of the greatest things in sports is the pro tracer in golf. Like, it's right there to me with HD, like hitting the ball on TV and exactly knowing exactly where it's going and not guessing. And they had that on the range where guys were hitting their ball, golf ball, on the range, and they would say, well, these are the last two driver shots by Brooks Koepka, and if we take that technology and project it onto the first tee, he'd be like 280 or 290 out right in the middle of the fairway. I'm like, that's why it's like the batting cagey. That's why it's good in practice, but taking it out onto the field of play, or in this case onto the course, is a whole different story.
You know what I find interesting about this as well? Is, and I acknowledge, I did not know this. I know you're like, listen, I like golf. You love golf. You're like golf geek when it comes to this stuff. I did not realize until today that for the Masters, it's the only tournament that doesn't have a green reading book where players aren't allowed to use it. I mean, if one exists, it's under lock and key behind closed doors somewhere. So, I mean, you're like Mr. Gadget. You're talking about this tracker here, but you get out on the course and you've got the viewfinder thing, and you're telling me how many yards and which way is the wind blowing and where the flag placement, this, that, whatever. But for these pros, every tournament that they go to, they've got a book telling them about the greens and the angles and whatever else. To not have that at the Masters, I mean, that to me, when we talk about that whole putt for dough type thing, that applies more than anything for this tournament, because it really is just about the field. And if you have no true knowledge of what the greens are doing or how they're playing, then that's got to be just, mind-blowing to a lot of these guys, and why we often see that even the best of the best get, you know, kind of gobbled up and eaten alive at the Masters.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you watch guys putt the ball off the green in some instances. You watch Ernie Els, what did he, 4-putt from like 6 feet, you know, for a 9 or something like that. It happens. And it just shows how good these guys are. It's such a hard game. And Augusta National doesn't always make it easier. They, you know, they're pretty good at watching how things look when they go up the flagpole. If the scores are low one day, they kind of set it up so they won't be low 2 days in a row. And I mean, that's why at one point the U.S. Open was my favorite tournament, because they would set it up to make a score of even par the winning score. And it was tough. And sometimes the pros complained about it, but you're the best in the world and you're getting a severe test of golf. Well, if you're the best, then take it on and don't complain about how high the rough is or well, the 1 year, I think it was at Shinnecock Hills. They were watering the greens because it was so fast. They were watering the greens during the round. I mean, it is amazing, Eric, when you think of how good these guys are and how much they're challenged at a place like Augusta.
We're going to continue to talk about the Masters. We're trying to track down Rex Hoggard from the Golf Channel. He was scheduled to join us, but obviously, understandably, he might be a little bit busy with the tournament well underway. So we're going to step aside for a quick commercial break here. We'll see if we can track down Rex, and if not, we'll continue to chat about it and update you on the scoreboard and much more when we continue on Smith and Jones right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Back on Smith and Jones, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. We're still trying to track down Rex Hoggard from Golf Channel. If we don't end up hooking up with him today, we'll try and maybe get him tomorrow or Monday. He might be very well busy, obviously, with the Masters well underway, the first round. He clearly has to do a tip of the cap to the bosses at the Golf Channel before worrying about Smith and Jones right here. So, again, we'll try to track him down. If not, we'll get him on another day. If you are keeping an eye on the television while you're listening to the show, maybe you saw this, but folks, if you haven't, fire up your highlight shows, get on Twitter, Instagram, whatever else. Just moments ago, in the last 2-3 minutes, Dustin Johnson with a pretty wild birdie chip on 11 that you're going to want to check out. You'll be seeing it on all the highlight shows tonight, no doubt about that. So check out the birdie chip from Dustin Johnson, again, on 11. It just happened a couple of minutes ago. And Jonesy, maybe that leads me to throw it over to you in terms of, I don't know, some guys that maybe you have your eye on for this year's Masters. And I've got to assume that a lot of people, like you maybe as well, would be eyeballing one of the greats in the game right now in DJ.
Yeah, I mean, he was dominant last year when he won. And that's one of the things I wanted to ask Rex, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk to some people at some point, how different the conditions were with an October, November Masters as opposed to an April Masters. What you know, the difference in the condition of the course. And then Dustin has to be, he's got to be one of the picks, Eric. The guy's world number one. Like I said, he dominated it last time. A couple other guys I like. I mean, he's got a bit of a temper at times, but his wife just had a baby, John Rahm. And last time that happened with Danny Willett in 2016, they talk about how your expectations change and your perspective changes. And this guy wins the Masters. John Rahm may just need that little bit of a, you know, not, you know, taking his 5-iron and ramming it back in his bag shaft first and being upset when he makes a bad shot. I mean, he's a guy that he's certainly got the ability. I love Brooks Koepka. He's one of these kind of new age gunslingers. Like, I know he's coming off knee surgery, and they say the walk is going to be more stressful for him than the actual swinging of the golf club, by the sounds of it. And it's the walk that's going to make it difficult on his knee. But he's a guy, he's kind of like DJ. You just, sometimes you can't tell if he's down 10 strokes or he's blowing the field away. He just kind of ambles on to the next hole, takes the swing, you know, and keeps playing. And a guy that I like, I mean, you can't, Justin Thomas is another one who you know, just won recently. But a guy that
the
I
players,
like is Louis.
Right? Just, he, yeah. He won the players, yeah.
Yeah, Louis Oosthuizen, who just always seems to play well at Augusta. And he's one of these kind of cool South African dudes, you know, cut like Ernie Els, Retief Goosen. They just kind of, you know, again, emotionless, just kind of hit it around, get around the course, and pretty soon you look up and the guy's, you know, 4, 5, 6 under. So those are the guys that I'm looking at. And I just love the tournament, E. I love the major tournaments. The Masters, believe it or not, is not my favorite. The U.S. Open is, the way they set up the course. But I love the major tournaments because all the big boys come out and they, you know, they're hunting big game all the way through.
Well, listen, I'm going to piggyback on a couple of your picks there at the risk of being repetitive. And I didn't enter a pool this year. I would have, but I didn't get involved in one. The thing that I like about John Rahm as well, Jonesy, you mentioned like the potential impact of the, you know, the baby boost that he might get. 3 straight top 10 finishes as well coming into this. So mm-hmm. It's not like he's playing poor or up and down. He's playing at a high right now. So coming into the Masters with 3 straight top 10s, DJ would be right towards the top of my list as well. But another guy that I think could be interesting is, we could argue whether big name or not or whatever, a guy that's perhaps arguably been a little bit up and down and whatnot, but Patrick Reed, because it goes back to what we discussed before going to the commercial break, is if it's about the short game a lot of the time and if it's about reading the greens, correct me if I'm wrong, I bow to your expertise more so than mine, but is he not one of the best putters currently on the tour over the last couple of seasons even? And if you've got a guy that can putt, then I think I'm putting my money towards a guy in the Masters more than any other tournament that can putt.
Yeah, especially at that place. And look, he went to Augusta State. I mean, he's familiar with everything there, in that sense. So, a lot of people look at him kind of with a side eye because of some of the tactics that have been that he's shown in the past, but. He's certainly a solid player and a good pick. And the thing that I'm looking at too is what's happened to Rory. Like, can he finally get this one to complete the career Grand Slam? Because every time he doesn't get it, the pressure mounts a little bit more on Rory, just a little bit more, a little bit more. And you wonder if he's going to eventually get one.
Okay, Jonesy, let me put a pin in that one for a second. I want to come back to Rory, but one last thing on Patrick Reed that I was going to mention, because I wasn't even going to say it, but you mentioned the tactics. This has nothing to do with tactics. This is, I guess, an unfortunate situation. But if I've got the story right as well, it was his wife on 2 days ago, I think it was on Tuesday, when she was out on the course and got caught on, I don't know, she had her AirPods or earbuds in or something, and she was talking on the course, and she got escorted out, so she's not there. So I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing for Patrick Reed that he won't have his wife there. Like, is he playing more inspired and fired up right now, or is he pissed off that his wife's gone and not going to be able to watch now because the Masters folks booted her out? But then speaking of tactics as well, what's your take on DeChambeau and earlier in the week? I mean, we're talking about a guy in general who's kind of cocky and brash and whatever else, but he's out there talking a big game. And that cockiness might be coming back to bite him with a little bit of karma as we start today.
Yeah, the golfing gods. I mean, it wasn't last year he said, Augusta's like a par 67 for me just because of the way he hits it. If I'm not mistaken, I think he missed the cut. So don't mess with the sports gods. Don't mess with the golfing gods. But did you see the footage of DeChambeau on the range with Vijay Singh standing behind him?
Yes, I did.
He was like a machine. He's crank a driver, catch the ball from the caddy, tee it up, crank another one. And I think Brandel Chambly on the Golf Channel said, my back would be in traction if I swung that hard. But he's, you know, people dig the long ball. And, you know, they like the old saying, that what was that when back in the with McGuire and Sosa, chicks dig the long ball. Hell, guys dig the long ball too. And, they were talking about his driver, how they think his putter has more loft than his driver and the way they've built that special thing for him. And I'll be interested to see if he's a little more humble this year and tries to get around the course a little bit differently.
All right, so we're going to get Rex Hoggard on another day. We're not going to be able to chat with him today. So let me put a bow in the conversation by going back to that pin I said. Rory McIlroy, to me, he's an interesting jumping-off point for this conversation that we probably have every year. And, Jonesy, all of the names, or most of the names that we've just mentioned, for what it's worth, you know, over the last 10 minutes or so, for the most part, they are the bigger names. And this is the interesting thing about sports, is we often will say, in all sports, not just in golf, but we love the underdog, and we love the idea of the underdog, and we hate the super teams, and we don't like the power teams and the dynasties. But at the end of the day, yeah, we do. Because we want to see the Lakers, and we want to see, you know, can James Harden and Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and the super-powered Nets make it to the finals, let alone win a championship. And we love watching the stars. So when the time Sunday rolls around, are we really going to be watching, you know, or wanting to watch three dudes that we really don't care about, or three guys that are maybe looking for their first win? Or are we going to want to see a final grouping with, like, Rory and DJ and DeChambeau, and like, you want to see the stars on the line, not the underdogs. You really don't.
You want a good leaderboard. You do. You want the big boys in the hunt. But it's like, you know, in 2016, it was okay when Danny Willett was in the hunt with some of the other big names. And if there's one guy in there, you can root for him. But you're right. You want to see a good leaderboard. And heck, maybe some guy will emerge as a star, being the underdog, if he can scratch out a win.
All right, tonight, the undermanned and arguably underdog Toronto Raptors in a huge game against the team that is right in front of them in the standings, the Chicago Bulls. So arguably must-win situation for the Raptors tonight, with only 8 players in uniform as the Raptors and Bulls go toe-to-toe. The Leafs off until the weekend, but the Toronto Blue Jays with their home opener, their home away from home opener, down in Dunedin facing the LA Angels. Thanks to our crew and to all of you, and thanks to our guest today, Stu Jackson. Baseball Central is coming up next for Paul Jones. I'm Eric Smith. It's been Smith and Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.